The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Matthew Clam. His new novel is called Who is Rich? And he joins us by telephone from some mysterious location on the East Coast. Where are you, sir?
I'm in Washington, D.C.
Well, your protagonist is from what, Tacoma Park? Isn't that the suburb of D.C.?
Yes, he is.
And the title, after we read the book, we might think it refers to your protagonist, but I'm seeing a deeper meaning in it.
Yeah, sure. I think there's two meanings in it. I think the book has a certain, you know, obsession with wealth, and there are a couple of characters who are important to the story who have a lot of money, and the effect of that money and its power over the narrator is a element of the story that has some importance, and so I guess the title works two ways that way.
I see it as a kind of a dark farce.
Uh-huh.
Do you agree?
Is it a dark farce? Well, this narrator goes through and I think between, you know, there are these two important characters in this book. There's this guy named Rich Fisher, who is away from his family for a few days, teaching a class on cartooning at an annual week-long summer conference, and a woman named Amy O'Donnell, who is the wife of a Wall Street big shot, who is like Rich, sort of at a crossroads. Maybe they both have small kids at home. They both have reached a point where they're sort of in shock at how their lives have turned out a bit. So there's and there's an awful lot of strong emotion from both of them, a lot of kind of hot material that they express throughout the book. I think there's a resolution of sorts in the end that leaves the narrator in one piece and able to return with some enthusiasm to his, you know, wife and small kids. He has sort of survived his five-day odyssey or whatever it is throughout the book. There's some farcical elements and some dark elements. Yeah, it's true.
Well, when we go to this what would we call it, a conference where he's teaching cartooning?
Yeah, it's like a summer arts conference. It's a kind of summer camp for grown-ups.
Yeah, and he really looks forward to this because this is his chance to commit adultery.
Yeah, that's one way of looking at it.
Well, isn't it true?
You know,
he thinks about that a lot.
When I was I had been to a couple of these conferences as a student, and then a bunch more as a faculty member, and it is kind of a summer camp for grown-ups.
Uh-huh.
And what I love about the setting is that mortgage, job, marriage, raising your kids, taking care of your pets, lawn care, that crack in the wall that needs repainting in your house, all that stuff for 5 days or 12 days or whatever it is, get set completely to the side, and you get to focus completely on something you love. I just want to get up on stage and read my poem. I just want to spend a couple of days with my seascape painting. You know, I just want to get back into musical theater. And for these two, there is that, but there's also, I mean, they both have some artistic ambitions, but they also have this, you know, they want to re-engage with their erotic alter ego. They're both, you know, have reached the place where they're looking for inspiration in their personal lives. You know, they've both been married for a while, and they have, you know, reached a kind of crossroads. And now this book, I think, brings up, you know, sort of watching adults making really life-altering decisions, some that could be quite risky, and we get to sort of watch that play out. And for them, there is that element of adultery, but there's also, I think, their all the decisions they've made in their lives are sort of coming to a head, and in this 5 days, and when they're kind of interacting.
Matthew Clam joins us. His novel is Who is Rich? And all this stuff that's coming up, it's the crest of a wave of what some people might characterize as a midlife crisis. But this guy, his mind's going a mile a minute, and we're inside his mind, and it's kind of a scary place to be. I can see how some people might think he's not a very likable character, but I liked him a lot. He's real. Okay. He's really genuine.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I was just trying to be as honest as I possibly could, sort of inside the skin of a fictional character who, in some ways, I have, you know, a kind of deep personal understanding of. But I also was really anxious to let him do the kinds of things that most of us in our conventional lives aren't allowed to do, you know. So, and again, this setting the story at one of these conferences where you're kind of putting aside your normal life, and instead there is this other self that emerges. It allowed me to kind of explore whatever things that he that any of us might have as, you know, ambitions or goals that we usually set aside in favor of a more conventional existence. You know, he's kind of wrapped up in them for a few days, and those have to do with making art, falling madly in love, feeling sexual ecstasy, considering like committing felonious crimes. He reaches a point of great joy and also despair. There's a he tries to hang himself with a belt, not once but twice, and fails, and emerges somehow in one piece. I mean, in a way, he sort of he breaks my heart, and I also sort of understand him and feel that I have been his main torturer and enabler.
Matthew, after I read that botched suicide attempt with the belt where you have his obituary in his own mind, that's the funniest attempted suicide scene I think I've ever read. I just laughed and laughed and laughed. That fake obituary was fabulous.
Thanks. Well, that, you know, for careful readers, I definitely owe and have no problem saying I owe to an amazing couple-page riff in Sabbath Theater, which I highly recommend for people who are admirers of dyspeptic protagonists. There's something that is going coursing through Mickey Sabbath's mind throughout that novel, Sabbath Theater, which is one reviewer in referring to my book called it a kind of casual suicidality, but it's definitely a sort of hell-bent, self-destructive streak, and it was kind of fun to write that, I think, you know, to allow his mind to kind of construct an obituary, which is an absurd obituary, and it's not the one that would run if one did run about him, but it's the one that he imagines at that moment as he's kind of failed once again to harm himself adequately.
Well, I'm always impressed when a humorist is so deft that humorist can turn a really unfunny subject into hilarity. James McBride comes to mind, turning slavery into a funny subject.
You really
do it up. And another thing he's reconnecting with in this workshop, in this conference, is cartooning, because this was really what he did. This is what he was famous for. And now the poor guy, his book's even out of print.
Yeah, you know, this idea of making a narrator a cartoonist had come to me when I had done something a lot like what the narrator is doing in this conference. I went to a cartooning kind of summer workshop just for kicks, and it was because I had been teaching graduate and undergraduate students at Johns Hopkins and was teaching the graphic novel. I don't really draw. I can draw a little. I can fake it a little bit. But I went up to this place at the Center of Cartoon Studies in Vermont, and I took a class for a week, and I just sat down with this guy. He's a cartoonist. His name is Jason Lutes, L-U-T-E-S. He's a very accomplished and masterful cartoonist. And we were just chatting, and he was supposed to sort of give me the portfolio consultation. But instead, I just asked him about his life, and it sounded just like a short story writer's life. At the time, that was what I was more known for, and I appreciated the fact that he said, you know, you could be sitting next to someone on an airplane, and they'd ask you what you do for a living. He said, you tell them that you're a cartoonist, and they just stop asking questions after that. They're just afraid for you, or they don't believe you. I don't know. Anyway, the same thing happens when you say to somebody, when they ask you what you do for a living, you say you're a short story writer. So I really identified with that. It seemed to be a kind of a there's a lot of ambition involved, but it's also a kind of quieter track for an artist. It seems to be a little bit more of a modest goal to be a short story writer than to be a novelist. And graphic novelists certainly know that even though this is a kind of golden or platinum age for cartooning and comics, you know, it's hard to make a living at it. And so I identified with this guy, and then I really was able to kind of indulge my own interest and read a couple of shelves full of cartoonists. And it's just a very direct way of communicating a story, and you never have to explain to anybody what a good comic is. I think it's just such a core part of our way of communicating, you know, going back centuries. Words and pictures, it just does it.
And he encounters this guy at the conference who is a cartoonist on top of things. He's got a great backstory. He's from Central America. He's sort of almost a Jerzy Kosinski type character. We don't know what's real about him.
Yeah, so you're referring to this guy. His name is Angel Salido, and he is one of these guys who, as a kid, essentially walked from Guatemala to the United States to find his parents. He had been trying and failing for years, and eventually, when he's 11 or 12 in the book, this is all part of this character's backstory, he reaches the United States, and he grows up or goes to high school and college, and he produces this graphic novel, which is really exploding as the conference is taking place. So my narrator, who is past his prime and anxious and insecure, is running into this young, hot cartoonist who sends waves of terror through him because he sees what he never had, and he sees how this kid has. I mean, he's not a kid. The kid is this man is 28 to the narrator's 42. Uh-huh. That Angel Salido has this kind of zeitgeist power, which is something that the narrator can't help but envy. And I think it's deserved. I think it's a fascinating story, and there are people, poets and writers, who are emerging more and more in our literary landscape, you know, who are writing about this journey. It's an amazing one.
My guest is Matthew Clam. We're talking about his new novel, Who is Rich? I really liked The Long-Suffering Wife. I really enjoyed this character a lot. I sympathize with her tremendously. For one thing, she's married to him.
Yeah. She's really, at the end of the day, she's really, I think, you know, something to be admired. I mean, she's not only does she tolerate him, and I think at the end of the book, you finally get a chance to see the substance of their relationship and that there is more to it than maybe you've been led to believe. But she also has this background. She was a TV photojournalist, a TV producer, who went into war zones all over Latin America. She's fluent in Spanish, and for whatever reason has this, well, there is a sort of explanation for where her fearlessness comes from. She had some tragedy in her life growing up, and it sets her up to be a kind of person who's able to take risks, and she goes into every single country in Latin America except the safe ones, pretty much, because that's where the news always is, you know. So she eventually, I think, tires of that in her backstory, and you hear that she's no longer willing to risk her life for, it's something like a 5-minute story on sea turtles or something, you know, off the coast of Honduras. But she's done that, and then she's become a television producer for some a kind of a nature channel, and you know, is trying to do worthwhile television, and before that had been doing, you know, this hard-hitting news. And she's got two little kids. One is 1 year old, the other is four. Like the husband, they are, you know, she is sleep-deprived, and they're struggling, and they don't want to sell out, but they're busy selling out to make their way in the world. And, yeah, and you hear a lot about the internal workings of their marriage.
There's a lot of subtle and not-so-subtle social commentary in here, and this is set in, what, the summer of 2012?
Yeah.
Because this is when we had President Obama running for re-election against Mitt Romney, who had the notorious leaked cell phone footage of him talking about various percentages. And I think that cost him the election myself. But this really ties in with this character, the lover, who is married to the billionaire.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, there's an attempt to show the effect of power and extreme wealth, power and how it's deployed, you know, for and against people. The husband and wife, this romantic, the person who the narrator is romantically entwined with, Amy, is, you know, a billionaire who's a very active philanthropist and is knowledgeable and is extremely hardworking, but she has an inevitable sort of, it's not, I mean, I would call it a neutrality. She's sort of neither a Democrat nor a Republican, but that's not enough for the narrator, who is a progressive lefty. Her work, some of it is in poor places around the world. Some of it is in, you know, our difficult, like Detroit, and doing education reform. You know, it's some of it is politically fraught, but is effective. So the narrator has his own opinions about who's allowed to help improve our education system, and he, I think, complains that she is, you know, a white billionaire attempting to dismantle public education, which is certainly an argument that one could make about education reform in our country. But she's also doing some real good things, and yeah, you know, it's a moment in our history. Looking back, geez, Mitt Romney. Uh-huh. I mean, he. It seems almost quaint now what the left was worried about coming from Mitt Romney. What a different time than right now.
Yeah, now we're living the fictional time. That's one of the beauties of writing fiction.
Writers haven't caught up yet.
Right, right. The curve is too fast. I don't know if you ever read Super Sad True Love Story by Gary Steingart, but you can't predict this stuff because it's happening so fast that by the time you publish the book, it's already happened.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and the beauty of fiction to me is that someone like you can sit there in your lonely garret writing this stuff, and your characters can live that life that you maybe wanted to live, or make those mistakes that you'd never want to make. And in this book, the iconic mistake revolves around a bracelet, and I don't really want to give anything away, but this bracelet, we're very nervous about it.
I don't know how to talk about it without giving anything
away.
Yeah,
right. Well, we don't.
I mean, you know, the creation of a fictional character is, you know, it's the sort of sum total of my own personal experience, which means stuff I've fantasized about, stuff I've overheard. I seem to have a kind of face where people confess to me. Mm. It's the sum of the treasure trove of literature I've read. And all that stuff goes into creating a character. And, yeah, I mean, I always, speaking of the sort of treasure trove of literature, I always found this book to be linked to the kind of, I think it's 6-day festival in Pamplona in The Sun Also Rises, where Hemingway has people do things that they wouldn't normally do. In that case, it's, you know, it's an adulterous affair, and it's a fight with a bullfighter, and it's a lot of alcoholism. And I kept coming back to it again and again because I knew that I wanted to make sure that the rules were slightly different, the laws of gravity were changed slightly during my conference the way they had been during that period in Pamplona.
I kept flashing on Philip Roth's Portnoy's Complaint myself. But
yeah. Definitely a lot of kind of visceral body conflict. You know, mm-hmm. it's not just about the sex. It's about the body literally in conflict with itself, you know. And, mm-hmm. I mean, the narrator complains. And I think, you know, it's his own sort of, what I want to say, stupidity that makes him constantly sort of sexualize his problems, when actually I think it's more than just sex that he's missing. Of course, he's missing a kind of intimacy, not just his connection to his wife, but a connection to his own needs that he's lost sight of. And it's partly because it's anything I think anybody can understand. If you've had a puppy, you know, if you've had construction going on outside your window, if you've had a baby, you know that feeling of being sleep deprived. For him, it's now, you know, going on years. It makes it hard to function, and I think one has to be sympathetic to that sleep deprived parent who has kind of lost their way.
I should note that there are some wonderful illustrations, cartoonish illustrations in your book, and I really enjoyed those.
This guy, John Cuneo, who has done brilliant covers for The New Yorker and columns, he's illustrated for every great magazine, and he's also just a little bit more sexually out there. He's a little racier than some other of the illustrators who I looked at, and we hit it off. And we had this really intense email exchange. I've never met him face-to-face, but I'm just about to send him the totally finished book now, and I'm really excited to put it in his hands. He was really so helpful, and he's so intuitive. I mean, it's the amazing thing about people who can draw for a living. They hear you, and then they translate it into a picture that's just it does all these things that they're hard to describe. But I think, yeah, it works, I think.
His work is very distinctive. Matthew Clam joins us. His novel is Who is Rich? Now, I understand that a number of years ago you put out a book called Sam the Cat that was very well received and got you a lot of attention, and a lot of good things happened to you. And all this time later, you finally put out another book. What have you been up to in the interim?
I feel like there are a couple of ways to answer that. You know, one is that I became a magazine journalist and wrote cover stories for the New York Times Magazine, GQ, Esquire, Harper's Magazine, got married, bought a house, had a kid, became a full-time professor. That's one way to answer it, and learned how to do all those things, commuting up to Baltimore from D.C. But the other thing is I think that it really was the case that it took me a few years to figure out. But I didn't want to write another short story. I just didn't want to, and I didn't know that. I just was stuck because I knew I didn't want to. I didn't know why. I didn't think I had a reason why I shouldn't. And I eventually sort of backed into beginning this book, and I didn't know it was a novel. I thought it was a short story, and then I thought it was a long short story, and then I thought it was a novella. I hoped it would end, you know, at 30 pages, and hoped it would end at 70, then hoped it would end at 125, and it just kept going. And so I started that in January of 2010. So between 2001 or 2 and 2010, I think I produced a book of nonfiction, of magazine journalism, but I also wasn't doing this stuff, and I did feel like I had something else to say, but I couldn't figure out what it was.
Mm. Well, like your cartoonist, I know someone who I've never met in person, but I consider to be a friend, and that is your sister, Julie Clam.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I've had her on the show a number of times. We've just done phone interviews like this one, and we've corresponded by email, and she wrote what I think is the greatest dog book ever, You Had Me at Woof.
Yeah.
And she's one of the nicest people that I have ever not met. A few years ago, she knew I was very close to an elderly dog that we had rescued, and I sent her an email, and I told her that my dog Maisie had died the night before. And a little bit later in the day, we live in the country, and we're like, why is this florist truck out here? And your sister had sent us the most beautiful flower arrangement for Maisie.
Yeah, she's a terrific sister, and she's also very dedicated to rescue dogs and her animals. We had a lot of animals growing up. I'm sure she probably mentioned in some of her books, but we had horses and dogs and cats and chickens. Mm-hmm.
And she's got a book coming out this month, too.
Yeah, she has a book about our culture of being obsessed with celebrity. And she's a very she's always been someone who had an extra level of interest and fascination with famous people. She was, I think the first celebrity I know she was in love with might have been Nicolas Cage. And the guys who, the lead singer from Squeeze. Anyway, yeah.
Glenn Tilbrook?
Yeah,
oh, wow. Sorry. What's that, Glenn Tilbrook?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, Chris Difford and Glenn Tilbrook.
Uh-huh, right.
Yeah.
Oh, my. This is good stuff. You know, I hope to have her on the show again in July for her new book when it comes out. And I did email her and say, I'm really excited. I've booked an interview with your brother, Matthew. Give me the dirt. And she wouldn't give me any dirt on you, Matthew.
Jeez. I don't think anybody needs to use their too much imagination. If they read my book, they'll know about the things I've thought and the impulses that I've had and hopefully resisted, and they'll have enough dirt right there, probably.
Oh, my. Are there elements of autobiography in this novel?
You know, I think it's inevitable, especially when you write in the first person, that there will be a reader who assumes that everything is true and that the narrator is me. And in fact, I'm not – I understand that impulse. I remember being at a reading, and Tim O'Brien was reading from The Things They Carried in 1993 or 4, and the journalists in the room were sort of shocked to find out that he was reading from – it must have been earlier. It must have been like 90 or 91 at Bread Loaf. And there was a group of people in the audience who were outraged, just shocked that he was writing using his first his name as the main character. And there were other people in the audience who were like, what time does the bar open? We don't care at all. But I do care about that stuff, and I'm interested in that stuff, and I – you know, I write, I think in a way every single thing in the book is true because it comes from my perceptions and my distortions. And on the other hand, it's impossible to write a character who is a duplicate of a real person. It's just once you begin constructing a character and you're weighed down by narrative demands, it's not paint by numbers. You're stuck trying to figure out their motivation. You're trying to figure out their style. You need to figure out what is the scene is about and what someone would say or do next. I mean, for anybody who writes, even if you had to write an email to the school principal saying you think that the math teacher has treated a kid unfairly and your own kid witnessed it, you're weighing problems already right there, and there's sort of narrative problems in your letter. You don't want to get the math teacher fired. You want to stick to the truth, but you also want to make sure that you don't overplay things. It's complicated, and you might sit on that email for a couple of days. The same thing happens in constructing a character in fiction, except it goes on for much longer. Mm. You're just, you know, even if you are attempting to represent reality, your the narrative demands, you know, force you to fictionalize. And that's good, you know. I mean, is it? Have I ever run into problems with real people from the things I've read? No, but there's always tomorrow, right?
Well, Matthew, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Vic.
My guest has been Matthew Clam. His new novel is Who Is Rich? For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes.